Airlines on the program today, potholes too, and a bunch of non-transportation related economic news as well. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday today, the 15th day of May. Good as always to have you along, everybody. China and the United States are the world's two biggest economies. That is fact number one. China and the United States are, at a very macro policy level and at a very businesses just trying to sell their stuff level as well, having some substantive disagreements on trade. That is fact number two. Fact number three is that it's entirely possible that consumers in both of those economies are getting sick and tired of fact number two. Case in point, retail sales data released in both countries today. In China, the slowest growth in retail in 16 years, still growing, have to say, just slower. Here, retail was down as well, not a lot, but a sign that consumers are a little squeamish, which is interesting because there have been some fairly high readings on the consumer confidence meter of late. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman explains what's going on.
First, let's just stipulate, U.S. consumers do have a lot going for them right now. Ben Herzon is an economist at IHS Market.
Healthy gains in jobs, increase of average hourly earnings, so income looks pretty good.
And consumers are feeling more upbeat than they were around the beginning of the year after the stock market tanked and the government shut down. But there are also some new drags on consumer sentiment, like higher gas prices.
When consumers see gasoline prices rising pretty sharply, it is a hit to confidence. After you fill up your tank, there's less left over for other spending.
Consumers aren't in retreat. They just appear a little more cautious about the future. Take 41-year-old G.R. Fielding. He's a civil engineer. His wife's a nurse. They live with their two young children near Aspen, Colorado. He says locally, things are going great. Home prices have been soaring.
Having our eye on the economy, we've decided to make a number of large purchases and double down on our house, making home improvements.
But he says now they're pretty much done with the big spending. They'll hunker down, pay off debt, and get ready for the next shoe to drop in the economy.
It's just been going so well for so long. Intuition tells me that something has to give at some point.
And there are some clouds on the horizon, says Scott Anderson, chief economist at Bank of the West.
We are seeing continued slowing in the global economy. We've got uncertainties coming from trade wars and tariffs.
And he says with loan delinquencies rising on car loans and credit cards, there are increasing signs lower and middle income consumers are strapped for cash. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Some indeterminate part of the market's gains today, about which more later, of course, were driven by news mid-morning-ish East Coast time that the White House is thinking about delaying tariffs on European cars that the president has been thinking out loud about imposing. That news, in turn, got us thinking about a guy we know who is indirectly involved in the American car industry. David Britt is on the Spartanburg County Council in South Carolina. 25 years ago, he was one of the people who convinced BMW to open a huge factory there. We met him a couple of 3 years ago and have talked to him a couple of times since, including today. David, welcome back to the program.
Good to talk to you too, Kai.
Last time we had you on, Mr. Britt, you were, so that was back in October, and you were a little concerned, I think it's fair to say, about the impact of the president's tariffs on the national economy, but also there in Spartanburg. How are you feeling now?
I am feeling very sick. In fact, I almost hate to get your phone calls because, you know, when we're talking, it's not good news for the most part. The president's, you know, steel tariffs, aluminum tariffs have had a dramatic effect on our growth and our economic development expansions. In fact, it was white hot for 2 years, and he's poured cold water on this development.
Give me some specifics. Can you have like project numbers or a sense of, can you quantify that?
Absolutely.
Yeah, go ahead.
From 2012 to 2015, we averaged 120 to 130 projects that we're actively looking at here in Spartanburg County. Like in 2017, we had right at $900 million invested in Spartanburg County, which translated to just under 2,000 new jobs. Last year, we were successful with $800 million. We landed 18 projects, 2,100 jobs. Going into 19, this is where the rubber hits the road.
As it were.
We had 81 projects that we were looking at. Right. And as of today, we have 30 that are active projects as of May 15th.
So what are people telling you? I mean, when you stop and visit for, you know, an iced tea or a lemonade like we did that day that I was down there when it was about a million degrees, what are people telling you? The people who are running these businesses that flow from, you know, the BMW plant and all those plants that you help bring there?
The business is saying we cannot make decisions. You know, and you know, we have 211 international companies here and just tons of local U.S. companies here. All of them are saying we can't afford the risk of making the investment in an expansion or new facility based on this president's uncertainty and his game of almost Russian roulette. You know, none of us would play Russian roulette. I wrote the president last year. I invited him to come to Spartanburg.
And?
He wrote me back in October. Obviously, he didn't listen to my letter because he didn't take me up on my offer and thank me for my support. But anyhow, everybody, and again, look at the numbers. Look at where BMW, the last time BMW made an investment in Plant Spartanburg was 2 years ago.
Right. And this is, we should say for the record, the biggest BMW factory in the world.
Producing 450,000 cars a year, employing 11,000 employees.
So look.
Right here in Spartanburg.
Aside from the form letter that you got back from the White House, clearly the president seems willing to let these tariffs, whatever tariffs we're talking about, stick around for a little while. The question to you as a guy involved in economic development at the county level is, how much time do you have to let these tariffs sit around?
The tariffs are just drawing the oxygen out of our economy, both in Spartanburg and South Carolina and the Southeast. And it's not going to be that $700 to $800 a year increase they're going to say. It's going to be devastating. It's happening right now. It's time to stop it.
David Britt from the Spartanburg County Council, he chairs the Economic Development Committee there, has for quite a long time. David, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Kai. You have a good day.
Wall Street, as I said, took great solace in the prospect of automobile tariffs being maybe, depending on how the president's feeling, not a right now thing. We will have the details when we do the numbers. We took a little field trip a couple of weeks ago out to the airport.
Good morning, flight 2005, service to Raleigh, Durham. We do have the...
I wasn't actually going anywhere. It's more like I was meeting somebody who was coming here. Ed Bastian, the CEO of Delta, arriving at LAX from Atlanta. We had him on about 3 years ago, just after he'd gotten the job. Delta was in the middle of a bit of turbulence, shall we say. Today, it's steadier flying, more lucrative as well. Delta reported record revenue the first quarter of this year. So out we went to the airport to talk to Ed Bastian, the CEO of the company.
Thanks for taking the time.
Well, thanks for coming out here.
Let's talk about, first of all, where we are. Tell me where we are.
We are right here in Terminals 2 and 3, the new LAX that we are building. We've got an opportunity to almost double the size of our footprint here in L.A. once we get done over the next several years.
Why do you need more footprint? I mean, that's going to sound like a basic question, but...
Well, first of all, our infrastructure, as we all know, our airports in the U.S. are in need of multi-generational build. Improved security flows, improved technology. And on top of that, you know, Delta's growing here. We've got a great group of people here. Our operations have doubled over the last 5 years, and we need more room.
Do you think commercial aviation, the way we're doing it today, is sustainable? Not in the climate sense, right? I mean, yes, there's emissions and jets and all that, but in the sheer business model sense, because you got crowds, you got infrastructure problems, you got security problems. Can we keep doing this way?
Absolutely.
No. Come on.
I think when you think about the reason why people are traveling, is they're more adventurous. So we're building bigger airplanes, we're building bigger airports because people want to go.
I talk to a lot of CEOs. I don't quote a lot of CEOs, but one that I do trot out pretty frequently is a line you gave me in 2016 when we met in Atlanta.
Right.
That any company that's not growing is in slow motion liquidation.
Yeah.
First of all, you still believe that?
I still believe that. I say you have to grow. You got to take scale. You got to provide new opportunities for your people and your customers.
Talk to me about global travel for a second. I was in Europe not too long ago. You see Delta planes all over the place over there. Asia, though, is where a lot of the global growth is in aviation. How much do you concentrate on Asia and that side of the market?
We're less concentrated on Asia than here closer to home, so the U.S. and Europe are probably 80% of our revenue base. Asia is a long ways away. It's more difficult to fly to. It's more expensive. There's a lot of competition that's owned by government sources, so the government-infused support going into some of the Asian airlines make it a little more difficult for an American company to compete. But that said, we're present. We've got a partner in China with China Eastern. We're at the hubs in both Shanghai and Beijing. Yeah. So, you know, you think about the world population, that's the part of the world that needs to grow quicker than anyone. India is another place that we're launching direct service to by the end of this year. We today don't fly direct to India.
You mentioned partners. So I'll bring this up, and I'll note that you're not a Boeing 737 MAX customer, but
we're
you do
not.
Fly Boeing aircraft.
We do.
Dennis Muilenburg, as you know, is having a tough time now trying to figure all that out and what to do about that. First of all, has he called you? Have you guys spoken?
I know Dennis well. I sent him a note of encouragement a few weeks ago and told him to stick in there.
Any concerns about Boeing as a partner for Delta Airlines?
I don't. So Boeing's a great company. It's a great American company. We fly more Boeing planes than any other manufacturer. We've always flown more Boeing, and we hope to fly more Boeing going forward.
With Delta doing so well, I'm sure you've seen the stories in the paper the last couple of days about corporate taxes and how much tax companies are paying. Delta is not paying a lot. Is that right, do you think?
Absolutely. You know, we're following the tax code. Delta, as you recall, lost a lot of money.
Yeah.
We lost almost $20 billion post 9/11. You know, we went through some very difficult economies over the last 20 years. And so what we're doing is we're able to offset the losses of those years against the profits of today. We probably only have about another year or so left in those losses, and then at that point, then we should start being a cash taxpayer once again. But you know, these are losses, hard-earned losses, I would say, that we utilize, and our people had real pain attached to them. I am proud that we've got the best profit-sharing plan in corporate America for our employees. They get 15% of the profits of the company. $1.3 billion we paid last year. So, you know, I think we're doing our share.
So, look, how much trouble are you in? $1.3 billion back to employees looks great, and I appreciate that. How much trouble are you in, though, in those coming years when you're not going to be able to share $1.3 billion? It's going to be $200 million or $600 million.
Well, I think we're going to continue to look to grow over $1 billion. We've had been over $1 billion 5 years in a row. So there's a resiliency. You know, we're a story that people don't pay enough attention to. And, you know, they throw the airlines into a basket. And they think that they're just a hot mess at times, right? They have some good boom-bust cycle. We're breaking that cycle. We're creating a new trend for the industry. And I see no reason why we should stop that.
I want to go back for a second to the bit about if you're not growing, you're dying, basically, the thing you shared with me in 2016. This is an incredibly competitive business. And last time we spoke, you were leaning into the competition part. You were like, I want to grow. I want to be number one. I want to do better than anybody else. Do you still feel that way?
Absolutely. You know, we're an industry that's geared towards growth. It's a high capital business. We've got a lot invested in this. We've got 80,000 employees, and that opportunity to grow and explore is fundamental to our ability to gain better leverage on our scale. So, yes, I think growth is really at the core of what it takes to be a great company in the airline space, but also as a fairly capital-intensive business as well.
Ed, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Safe travels.
I got to add a couple of things here. First of all, after we did that interview, some anti-union flyers and pamphlets that Delta had distributed wound up on social media. And in the way things do these days, they kind of blew up. We asked Delta to respond. Here is some of what they sent us. The direct relationship we have with our employees is at the very core of our strong culture, and it has enabled continuous investments in Delta people. The statement goes on to say, Delta has shared many communications, which on the whole make clear that deciding whether or not to unionize should not be taken lightly. We've got the whole statement on our website, if you're curious. We've also got the whole interview I did with Ed Bastian, including the company's plans to expand at airports like LAX and where he sees the Delta brand going on our Corner Office podcast, so check that out. Also, because you can never have enough, if you are planning a flight, you know picking the right ticket can be a headache, right? Do you go with a low-cost airline, maybe basic economy? We did the legwork for you. How much a route on a low-cost airline might run you compared to a legacy carrier? You can check it out at marketplace.org. Coming up.
My whole tire is split in half. That's how bad they are. It's split completely in half.
How one city is fixing its roads, cross-checking potholes with social equity. But first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 115 points today, 0.4%. Closed at 25,648 did the blue chips. The NASDAQ advanced 87 points, about 1.1%. 78 to 22. The S&P 500 found 16 points, half a percent, 28 and 50 there. As we talked about, in European auto tariffs, Guy, are, you know, conceivably on hold. Ford up 1.1% on that news. General Motors gained 0.8%. Macy's stock rose by as much as 4% on positive first quarter results, but fell back after warning it could see an impact from the U.S.-China trade dispute. Where have you heard that before? Macy's closed down 0.4% today. McDonald's says it's going to let individual franchises decide which breakfast foods to serve all day long. It's an effort, in theory, to simplify things for stores and reduce wait times for customers. Investors, yeah, lukewarm. McDonald's gained about 0.5% today. Bonds rose. Yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.37%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Alice Rivlin, as we mentioned at the end of the program yesterday, has died at the age of 88, probably best known among policy wonks anyway, as the founding director of the Congressional Budget Office. And I use wonks there with the most complimentary attitude possible, because under Rivlin, the CBO established its reputation for nonpartisan analysis of proposed legislation. Here's a bill. How much is it going to cost? How much revenue is it going to bring in? And how is that going to affect the economy? Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson takes a look at the creation of the CBO and Rivlin's legacy there.
It was 1974. A Democratic Congress was in the midst of budget battles with Republican President Richard Nixon, who was also in the midst of Watergate.
The Nixon administration had a new practice of refusing to spend money that Congress had appropriated and authorized for particular purposes.
Sarah Binder at George Washington University says Congress decided it needed its own source of budget information. It had been getting that information from the executive branch, the Office of Management and Budget.
One senator talks to the other and says, hey, what do you think happens if we pass our bill? I don't know. Let's call up OMB and ask. Well, can we trust them? That was the problem.
Douglas Holtz Aiken is president of the American Action Forum and a former CBO director. He says it was Rivlin who really coded independence into the agency's DNA.
The CBO had been created by Democrats. She was a Democrat, and she did nothing that would make them happy. And thereby establishing that it was the job of the CBO to tell people unpleasant truths, regardless of the circumstances.
It was a role she defended throughout her career.
My most important contribution, I think,
here she is testifying before Congress last year,
was insisting that CBO not make policy recommendations.
Objective information and analysis, yes. Costs for policy alternatives, too.
But it would not presume to tell Congress what to do.
And that's helped the CBO maintain its nonpartisan reputation, says Holtz Aiken.
And the CBO, through the sheer power of being very good at what it does, has acquired its influence.
But he says the CBO is often the bearer of bad news. If it's not being attacked, it likely isn't doing its job. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
So here's a question for the city planners among you who also happen to be social scientists. What is the best way to fix the local roads? Not technically, I mean strategically, right? If you're a city, what do you pave first? The busiest streets or the ones in the worst shape? The city of Oakland, California is trying to tackle its backlog of bad roads. And last week, the city council voted to use revenues from new voter-approved taxes, $100 million worth, to repair roads in a racially and economically equitable way. Marketplace's Ben Bradford looks at how potholes and equity are related.
Oakland's potholes are notorious among the city's residents, like Tracy Green.
Some of them are big enough that if it rained, my little great-nephew could swim in them potholes.
Shantoria Thompson drove over one last week while taking her daughter to preschool.
My whole tire is split in half. That's how bad they are. It's split completely in half.
In the Fruitvale neighborhood, a block of 44th Avenue looks like it survived the climactic fight in a superhero film. Cars wind around six-inch deep craters.
It's very iconic to me when it comes to potholes.
Itzel Diaz-Romo moved to Fruitvale 13 years ago from Mexico.
And in the whole time that I've lived in the U.S., like, they've never fixed this street.
Diaz-Romo works for local community group, the Unity Council. She says in low-income neighborhoods like Fruitvale, bad roads are more than an inconvenience. They're a symbol.
It's just a constant reminder, oh, of course, you know, this is a poor neighborhood. Like, we're low priority when it comes to fixing this stuff.
Oakland's new paving plan tries to address this disparity by prioritizing road repairs in minority and low-income neighborhoods.
It's one piece of the puzzle that can be used to fight historical injustice.
Oakland Transportation Director Ryan Russo acknowledges that's a departure from how cities typically plan.
The base, rational way of doing it would be purely on asset condition, the roads that are most deteriorated and fix them, and also factor in the importance of that road.
Instead, Fruitvale and East Oakland will receive almost half the new money set aside for local street paving, despite having only about a third of the roads needing repair. That's not going over well in some wealthier communities. North Hills resident Hillary Conlon drives me around the winding roads of her neighborhood.
Yikes.
They're not great. Conlon says she supports investing in lower-income areas, but her community needs a larger share of the funding for public safety reasons.
There has been a fire in the Oakland Hills every 20 years, so we're due now. We want to make sure that we can get out and that our roads are going to suffice.
Over in affluent Montclair, homeowner Michael Tiggs also notes a financial concern.
We're the ones that are paying for it, you might say, because it's a parcel tax. Those who own property are the ones that are paying for it.
So how do cities balance these competing concerns? Tamika Butler is a transportation planner who directs equity and inclusion at Tool Design. She says race and income should be factored into the equation.
We know there are certain communities that have historically been discriminated against, have historically been left out of resources. And so true equity means the folks who have historically had the least get the most.
On a practical level, she says bad roads also hurt households with tight budgets more.
While other people might say, oh, I got a flat, not a big deal, that is a huge deal. That might be the difference between feeding your kids dinner.
AAA's found the average pothole-related repair costs over $300. Back in Fruitvale, looking over pockmarked 44th Avenue, Itzel Diaz-Romo hopes better roads could also inspire more community engagement.
If streets like this get fixed, people in the neighborhood will say, oh, like, we're not forgotten. Like, we're not ignored.
In other words, a little bit of good road can go a long way. In Oakland, I'm Ben Bradford for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, about which I'm not really sure how I feel. Hershey's said today on Twitter that it's changing its iconic chocolate bar. Instead of just Hershey's imprinted on the bar in plain block letters like it ought to be, this summer the company is releasing the Emoji Bar, which is just like it sounds. From the tweet, you heart emojis, now you can taste them. And guess what? They taste like delicious chocolate. No, Hershey's. No, they don't. All right, we got to go. The Dow Industrial is up 115 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 87 points, about 1.1%. S&P 500 found 16 points in the couch cushions, about 0.5%. Our media production team includes Sarah Bergere, Jake Gorski, Drew Jostak, Jeff Peters, Dan Powell, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.